Now, the shotgun start in golf is full of mathematics. There's a lot of setup work that we have to do in order to make a tournament work. So I'm going to demonstrate to you just exactly how we do a shotgun start here.
And here we go.
All right, all right, all right. Gentlemen, start your engine!
Greetings and welcome to a Friday edition of the Shotgun Start. It is November 19th. Shane, how you doing?
I'm good, man. So happy to be on here.
All right. It is Friday morning, mid-morning release. We have Shane Ryan. He is a writer. You're probably familiar with him. If you're a listener of this podcast, you're familiar with Shane. He's a writer for Golf Digest. He has a book coming out. Do we have a time of when that will be released? I assume late this year, early next year.
I wish that were true.
Yeah, it's coming out.
I had to work hard to write it, to submit it by, you know, mid-November, but it's not coming out till May. They kind of target it for, you know, when the major start, but
okay,
you know, compared to what we do on the internet, it takes so long for a book to come out.
I was gonna say, I was surprised that it's already available for pre-order, right? It's called The Cup They Couldn't Lose. You were tweeting about it this week. You are officially done writing the first draft. What's that process like? Are you going to have to write a lot more?
I don't know the answer to that question. I think every editor is different, and I have a new one this time, and I really like him. But like my last editor for Slaying the Tiger, the first book I wrote, didn't do anything, which is fine. You know, it's kind of like their role sometimes is more marketing and PR, but so that book, I turned in a draft that was way too long because I thought that Microsoft Word pages were the same as book pages. So this is true. I turned it in and the editor came back and said, as it stands, your book is over 800 pages. He's like, we're not going to publish that. So he's like, go back and literally take half of it out. And I did that. And once I did that, it was basically, that was it. This time, you know, I knew going, I did write an 800 page book this time, which is great. The one thing I did do was I kind of agreed to a deadline of November 1st, which would give me a month to write the book after the Ryder Cup.
Okay.
I don't recommend that. I don't recommend that at all. It was like high pressure. It's kind of great that it's over now. And I think, you know, I think the book is really good and I think people are going to love it, but oh my God. I took a few extra days, but writing a book in about 40 days is insane. It's just something I'll never do again. I write fast. And even for me, it was overwhelming to sit there October 1st going, oh my God, I've got a month to write literally an entire book.
All right. So you're at the RSM right now. You're in Sea Island. You also have some thoughts on the fall series. I think that maybe run counter to the misanthropes on golf Twitter. Maybe, I don't know. We'll suss that out more. But now that we're on the book, let's stay on the book. So the title is The Cup They Couldn't Lose. What is the arch? You wrote it in 40 days. What's sort of the elevator pitch of it? It's a Ryder Cup book. I'd say you fell in love with the Ryder Cup, right? You were at Medina and you kind of like stumbled into this and you're like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. And here you are 9 years, nine years later writing a book on it. What is the arc of the book?
You're right. No, asking me for the elevator pitch is good because this will be like a comedian touring his material for the first time. It's going to be horrible because I haven't even thought about it. But yeah, you know, I worked for Grantland in 2012 and I wasn't at that time a huge golf fan. I didn't grow up playing golf, but I'd always loved the Ryder Cup. And luckily there were no other golf people at Grantland. So when I asked them to send me to Medina, it was no competition. And so I went and that just increased my love. What an insane tournament that was. But yeah, so the arc, the elevator pitch, sorry, my wife keeps calling me.
You're good.
The elevator pitch for this book is that starting in the 80s, Tony Jacklin transformed the Ryder Cup institution for Europe. And what he did was he set a strategic template that the Europeans followed down the decades. They treated it like a team sport. They had strategy. And because of that, they routinely beat better American teams. And for the longest time, America didn't understand what was happening to them because they had done nothing but win for the 50 years prior to that. And they thought they should still win because they had better golfers. It took until really Paul Azinger in 2008 or the embarrassment at Glen Eagles for the Americans to realize the term I really like, a concept is called institutional memory. And what it means is that you learn from what happened before, both successes and failures. And prior to that, the Americans had really had an ad hoc approach. It changed every 2 years, and they never figured out how to strategically match the Europeans. And what's happened now is that since 2014, they are learning, and they are learning quickly. And for me, what Whistling Straits was an answer to the question I had had for years, which is what would happen if you take the smart European tactics and put it onto an American team that is always, you know, insanely talented? Yeah. And, you know, the answer is 19-9.
Okay. Do you feel like it is, do you feel like this is carrying over to a European venue? I feel like somebody asked that. I think it was you, maybe. Like, is this story over unless, I think it was Spieth, right? He said it's still unfinished business until we go win in Italy, or like continuing this progress, this institutional memory now needs to be carried over to a European venue. As sort of an editor, you know, writer, cover, chronicler of this, do you agree with that?
I think it should. And it's always tough because you're going to have a new captain and they have to keep it going. I would assume it would be Zach Johnson. I don't have any inside info, but that certainly seems to be, you know, the trajectory. But, you know, I spoke with Davis Love after the Ryder Cup and he said something that was interesting. He said, you know, we're going to learn from Whistling Straits. And I said, well, you just won 19-9. It's the grand, what can you possibly learn? And he went into these details of like, you know, there's stuff with the food that we could have done better. There was stuff with the gyms. And you hear that and you're like, it kind of is easy to laugh at, but you're like, these guys are obsessed with this now. You know what I mean? They are thinking of every single little angle. So, okay, there are things that were great at Whistling Straits, like Stricker got everybody to come a week early in practice. And I think that was really important. Can you do that in Rome? I mean, that's way harder to do in Rome, right? You're going to have the fans be against you. Everything is much, much harder, which is why the U.S. hasn't won there in 30 years now. But I agree with Spieth that it's unfinished business until they can do it. But I think they have the best chance possible to do it this coming time.
Okay, so I find this interesting. So you're talking about like meals and gym time. It's like they're approaching the event, and we always talk about this, the event that doesn't pay them anything with the most sort of granular, you get some pay. There's obviously marketability that comes out of this. There's, you know, it's the PGA is making a boatload and European Tour is making money, but like just sort of the granular prep and thought that is going into an event that does not make them any, doesn't have a purse at the end of the day. It's sort of, I don't know. I'm sure this is all covered in the book, but every detail nugget like that comes out sort of reinforces that point of why this may be the greatest event in golf, why the greatest event, some argue, in sports. I don't know. That's interesting to hear that DL3.
It is. Yeah. And Love had an interesting perspective as a player too, because when he grew up, I think he was born in the early 60s. And so, you know, the Ryder Cup didn't become good until he was, you know, well into his professional career. And so he said openly, making the U.S. Ryder Cup team is not a priority for me. And I think what the Europeans did, you know, Europeans have this built-in passion to beat America, right? They have to prove themselves because America has been for decades the preeminent golfing power, and they probably always will be. And so there's a chip on their shoulder for the Europeans. And for the longest time, the U.S. had trouble catching up to that because they're going – like, wait, why? You know, why should I care? Like, it's just, especially guys who grew up when the Ryder Cup was just a blowout, like Love did.
Yeah.
Now, what you have is a generation of players who grew up watching the Americans get killed, right? And so they have a chip on their shoulders just based on that. Guys like, you know, Spieth or Scottie Scheffler or Justin Thomas, and they really care. And so, you know, part of the coup of what Steve Stricker did and what, you know, Love did and Hazeltine and everything is getting these guys to care. But that is much easier for them than it would have been for their captains back when, you know, the Ryder Cup wasn't in America's minds the unbelievably passionate, competitive institution that it is now.
So you've been in every Ryder Cup since Medina as in a working capacity, right? You went to Glen Eagles, or did you go to Paris?
Not Paris. One of them. But yeah, all the others.
How'd you find this most recent one, Whistling Straits versus the other? I mean, thinking about it, watching the 2014 press conference, I mean, it was one of my most memorable moments covering the game. I know you were in the room. That has to stick out if I were there. I found this most recent one to be less compelling in terms of there was less tension, less drama, of course, on the scoreboard. There was certainly pressure on the United States. The arena felt a little more removed. I don't know. I'm just as someone who's been to so many now. You were at Medina. Hazeltine was sort of a cauldron. What's been one of the most compelling ones you've been to? And then how was this most recent one stack up?
Yeah, I think probably the most compelling from a competitive angle was definitely Medina because it was so close. At this point, you know, working for 3 years on the Ryder Cup, studying the history so much, what became interesting to me are these broader trends of what makes a successful Ryder Cup team. What does Europe have to learn? What does America have to learn? And so I was looking at it from that angle. And again, this is not like average fan stuff, but even blowouts to me are really interesting. And working up to that Ryder Cup, I kept getting the sense, especially once Stricker did his captain's picks and you saw Patrick Harrington do his, and to be fair, I wrote this, so I can back it up. There's historical documentation. Yeah. But leading up to it, I was like, I think America is going to win and win huge here. And so to watch that play out was very, very interesting for me. But it was such a weird one in that the most dramatic session for me was Saturday afternoon, because that was when the U.S. was pushing to get 11 points. And you feel like 11 points is the point of no return. Like, you can't – look, this team was so good. I don't think they were coming back. The Europeans – even if it was 9-7, I don't think the Europeans were coming back. But 11-5 puts it beyond all doubt. And so to watch them push for that and to see the tactics that Stricker used, for me it was really, really interesting. But then I guess in the back of my mind, there was a thing of like, you know what, Shane, you're about to write a book about a Ryder Cup that ended 19-9. There was that. But I honestly didn't care, because the book is so historical and it takes that angle to such a degree that I still – just all Ryder Cups are fascinating to me, you know, despite the fact that Sunday was just, you know, kind of a coronation.
You talk about trends in this institution memory year over year. Like, I think this is probably why where the book serves as a valuable tool is like – one thing we kept hearing coming out of that is like, where's the young blood? Who's going to replenish the European side? And then, you know, the counter to that will be 2 years is a long time. And you're looking at a 3-day snapshot that might be, may not be indicative of any of the golf that was played in the prior 62 days of those players. But how do you find that blend between trends, like year over year structure, program building versus 2 years is a long time, and you know, golf is golf and it's a fickle thing, and anything can happen in 3 days. Is that where the book that sounds like the tool that this book provides, right? The service that this book could provide, blending that.
And I think that's part of what makes the Ryder Cup so interesting, because you can have these sort of anomalous performances where you're like, wow, Rory just went and won a tournament like a week later. Why was he so bad? Why did he not make a birdie in one of his matches with Ian Poulter? And I think that's the team element. And this is the hardest thing to convince people, that you can play better or worse based on how you're prepared and how your team runs. And, you know, Chris Solomon, our friend, he had a great take watching the Solheim Cup, where it finally clicked in for him that, yeah, it makes sense that actually your performance is elevated by your team spirit and by like strategies and things like that. Mm-hmm. Captains can do so much. And I think a lot of times people explain it away as saying, well, here you go, it's just a small sample size. That's why these people played poorly and these people played well. But actually, I think what happens sometimes is that people play differently than they do otherwise. And that can also mean playing better based on what is so unique about the Ryder Cup and how your team plays and everything like that. It's like Ian Poulter. He played the best he had ever played recently at the Ryder Cup. I mean, he was so good. He happened to be paired with Rory, so he didn't win, but then he went and beat Tony Finau on Sunday. There's just certain guys and certain things. And to go back to your point about the European younger talent, it is true that 2 years is a long time, and obviously winning on the road is tough. But you start to go, well, the other than like John Rahm and Rory, like who do they really have? And all these old guys, like all these guys who have been legends for them for so long, are either going to be gone for sure, like Westwood. It's impossible to see him making it. Or if you do take them, they're going to be like in their mid-40s. And it's, yeah, things are really changing, and they need to find some great Ryder Cup players quick.
All right, well, the book is The Cup They Couldn't Lose. You can order it now. Just order it now, and it'll show up whenever it comes out in May, you think?
That's right. You can pre-order it, Amazon,
all the big, you know.
All the big, yep.
The Cup They Couldn't Lose. What was the most, what was like the most despairing moment or most pressurized moment of writing a book in 40 days where you're like, oh shit. Was there ever, you write fast. I mean, you got it done. Was there ever a time where you're like, it seems like you've done years of work and research. It wasn't like you just sat down cold and had to write. Yeah. But was there a moment in the process that was like intense or sort of on the tightrope?
Yeah, I took a weekend off to play in a golf tournament with some friends. And then so I was like, all right, you took 3 days off. You got to hit the ground running this next Monday, right? And so I wrote that Monday morning, I wrote the Steve Stricker chapter. And I was very happy with it. It was about, you know, 5,000 words. And then my Microsoft Word, all of a sudden, all the text turned to asterisks. Oh, God. And I was like, what? I've never seen anything like that before. And I started Googling it, and it's like a real problem. It's like a real bug in whatever version I was using. There's absolutely no way to fix it. I hadn't saved any of it. Oh, and so that was a real moment where I was like, there are two options here. One is to like, you know, I spent a half hour trying to recover it. It was clear it was not going to. And it was like, okay, one of two things happens here. Either you just completely melt down and give up and the rest of your life is a disappointment, or or you have to immediately write this chapter. Like you just have to like do it right now.
Right now.
And I did. And I you know, I had like the memory of having written the chapter, so it probably went a little quicker than a normal chapter would.
Sure.
And I just finished it. And of course, you know, saving every 5 minutes after that and copying and pasting into Google Docs. But that was the moment, I think that was like the moment of truth where it almost inspired me a little, because I'm like, all right, universe, like you really are testing me here. So that all was right.
Well, that story is worth your whatever. It's $16 alone. Pre-order that story alone. Redeem that. All right. So you are on the road at the moment. It's part of also why you want, I saw you tweeting about your book coming out. You're on the road. You're at the RSM Classic. I think that's what the official title now. It's the Sea Island stop. It's always been the last stop before Thanksgiving, I think. It's been a fall series. Paint a picture of what the scene is like on the ground there. What my contention here for 3 or 4 years is that the PGA Tour has a lot of superfluous events, and I would consider this to be the most superfluous. I'm not saying it's bad. It clearly exists because they can put up FedEx Cup points in a purse. And players will show up and players live in the area. But it's already a golf resort. It's not drawing any new fans in. It's not going to be an atmosphere. The broadcast isn't going to pop. Like, it just feels like a missed opportunity to do something new or different. That's always been my contention. But maybe like the point of playing golf on tour at this point is just to get those points and money and play at a comfortable stop. It can't be too lively there. What's the scene like at the RSM?
Yeah, it's not super lively. It's known for being a very laid back event. Right. I mean, that's kind
which
of
is
like
fine.
Is fine. It's this whole thing. It's beautiful. I mean, I really like coming here because I can drive here. I live in North Carolina, so I can drive down. And so, like, selfishly, there's a lot I enjoy about it.
Yeah.
Very easy to talk to people. Like, I just did a story that I just filed about this like Sea Island Mafia, right? There's like dozens of people who live here. Some like a lot on the PGA Tour, but also developmental tours, and now they have like trainers and sports psychologists and caddies, everybody's moving here. So it's kind of like mini tour life. It's like a fantasy camp. You can really get good access. I always love talking to Davis Love. He's one of those guys that's always really fun to talk to. Okay. So selfishly, like this for a media member, it's a really great thing. I talked to Luke Donald and Justin Rose about the Ryder Cup, et cetera, et cetera. But from a fan's angle, we were joking earlier about fall golf and my quote unquote love for it. I feel like that's like an affectation for me. Like if I had a corncob pipe or something, like that's my like fall golf love. I don't really mean it, but you know, I'll keep that corncob pipe. But you're right that they could do something new, but what really could you do that would be exciting at this time of year? You know what I mean? I just don't know like what that would mean, unless they did a match play tournament or something. Sure. But You know, for what it's worth, it's like, okay, you've got a pretty decent field here. It's calm, it's laid back. Is it like a great TV product? I don't know.
No,
you know, I
mean, no.
Yeah.
I think my bone to pick has always been like it felt like Houston last week is in the city, right? It's something new. It's something different. It's a municipal course. I just felt like, I don't know, some market out there that's not already in the boat, which Sea Island is very much in the boat in terms of golf, recreational, pro, hotbed. I don't know what that is. Charleston. I don't know. They go everywhere. They play every week. So there's options. There's not a lot of options, but that's always been my pushback. So anything this week that's percolating as you're walking around? It seems like the course is extremely, I don't know, defenseless yesterday. The wind's supposed to be up. Like I think it was the second lowest scoring average in a long time, maybe ever yesterday. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going 8, 9, 10 under. I don't know. It's interesting to hear you talk about, maybe this is for the media and the players. Sean Martin always contends this is his favorite event because he can drive up from Jacksonville really quickly. He gets easy access. It's laid back. There's not a ton of, you know, apparatus and obstacles. So maybe it's not meant to be, you know, the U.S. Open or anything like that, clearly. But is there anything this week that's particularly sticks out in your mind? It feels like we're at the end of just like a 20-month slog is what it feels like, to be honest with you. But what's the theme for you this week?
Yeah, no, I do like that idea, by the way, of like, you know, look, if you're bored watching it at home, just take solace in the fact that the journalists are happy.
Right. They're happy.
Yeah, no, it is. It does feel like, yeah, like this season has been particularly long because of COVID and everything that happened. It just feels, yeah, it totally does. What's the theme of this week? Great question.
The mafia, probably, right?
That's always the story. And like, you can even tell the guys are really good, but you can even tell talking with them, it's like every year they have to, every year somebody writes the story.
Yeah.
And you know, this year, like it was me. I tried to take a different angle of like, you know, what life is like, but so there's that theme. I mean, there's little things like, it's kind of interesting that even though they have, you know, 15 people in it every year, no Sea Island person has ever won this thing. Like you have guys who, there could be a story of, you know, last year Robert Streb won, and it's like guys who haven't won in a long time have a chance here. Like you said, with no wind yesterday, there was just incredible scoring, particularly at the seaside course, which needs the wind to have any kind of defense. And other than that, you know, it just depends on the players. It's just kind of, yeah, you're not going to have some overarching exciting thing before you see like the drama on Sunday. But, you know, as we saw with like Rory or you know, like Victor Hovland, there can be kind of fun finishes to these events. And I think that's just what you have to take for them. And otherwise, maybe just not take it too seriously and try to just enjoy the golf, I guess. I mean, that's all you can do.
I think like give in the current moment with these sort of upstart leagues or ideas, I would say they're not leagues, they're ideas percolating out there. Like the contrast of those conversations, which is all they are, like what could be, what this should be versus watching, you know, like another event where it's, you know, Ches Reavy versus Tag Ridings versus Jonathan Vegas and everybody's shooting 63. Like those are incredible. They're in the top 0.1% players, golfers in the world. It's like, I think this fall series has particularly stood out in contrast. Now, again, those aren't like actual products. It's conversations of people. I guess Live Golf Investments has put money into something that may or may not ever go anywhere. But I think that's what I found interesting is turning on the TV, seeing like, you know, I hate saying like Russell Henley interview and then a Grayson Sigg shot and then a William McGirt shot. And you're like, it stands in contrast to those conversations that are happening right now.
It's a really good point. And also it's like these fall events, if that were ever to be successful, like a Saudi Golf League or whatever, like these fall events probably would not exist in nearly the same way. Right. I mean, these exist because of the strength of the PGA Tour and that, totally. It's like a publishing company, right? Like Harry Potter pays for everybody else to write books. Yeah. And if you didn't have like the Harry Potters, you know what I mean? Like it would, these other books exist because of like the big things, the big draws. And if you took away the big draws or you diluted it in some way, you're not going to have a tournament where you see like Grayson Sigg and Ches Reavy or whatever. Yeah. And like from a spectator perspective, you might say, who cares? But I don't know. I just look, it's easy to disagree on this stuff, but I just think like it's kind of like a high tide raises all boats. And I think it's good that you have these things. And I'm not saying it's going to be the most exciting event you watch all year. Obviously it's not. But it's, you know, a thriving PGA Tour ecosystem is good for golf. I'm, you know, I've always been against like the Saudi idea.
Sure.
But I do think, yeah, I guess I would just say that like this is, these things exist because of the strength of the PGA Tour that, and yeah, and they simply wouldn't, like if you didn't have like Rory McIlroy and all these great players supporting it, what would these fall events be? Who would watch it? How would you finance it? You know, et cetera.
How would you get, you might not end up with a guy getting DQ'd for a sticker on his driver. That was the big drama of the opening round. Our beloved boy from Bratislava here, he's a favorite of the shotgun start. DQ'd for what was it? It was like a launch monitor sticker tracking device on the face of
that
the driver?
That seemed like what it was, yeah. Okay. That, and they wouldn't say specifically, but it seemed almost definite that it was something he used on the range and forgot to take off. That it was like a launch monitor thing that you use. The sticker itself like syncs up with the monitor and gives you all the data and analyzes your swing. And so, yeah, you would use it on the range to practice, and it seems like he forgot to take the sticker off. And now there are riots in Slovakia. So
my big contention is that all the driver could have been hot. The face could have been hot as the surface of the sun, but the sticker is the one thing that got him in trouble because they're not testing all the drivers. That's what we always say. So I would say from a winner standpoint, this has been a strong fall. You had a Sam Burns, you had a Rory, you had a Hovland, Hideki winning in Japan. Max Homa is a big name, let's be honest, a favorite of certainly Twitter has penetrated the larger golf ecosystem, certainly when it comes to awareness. It's been a strong fall. And for me, though, in terms of winners, for me, it's been a little less inspiring. And I think it's just because we've played nothing but golf nonstop since June of 2020, that colonial restart with seven majors kind of rapidly firing through them. But you wrote an article for Golf Digest this week about your favorite moments from the fall series. For the listeners, what was your top moment from the fall series?
I think it was Tiger. Tiger winning the Zozo. I think that tied him with Snead for 82 wins. 82 PGA Tour wins.
The chase for 82. What do you find, I don't know, endearing about the fall? Whereas a lot of people tend to just bag on it. Like, this is when we watch football. It shouldn't exist. Or this is just like...
Yeah.
It seems like there may be some reformation coming. There may not be FedEx Cup point. There's all these rumors about whether it'll be more European dominated with the strategic alliance. What have you found endearing about in your years covering the game about the fall series?
The funny thing to me about the football argument is that, like, you can just go watch football.
Yeah.
Right. There's not, like, no fan signs a contract with the PGA Tour that's like, I must watch this many events per year. It's like, sure, just don't watch. Like, do you like golf? And then you may tune in or not, you know, for the fall events. Yeah, it's like totally up to you, but it's a bonus. So I don't know. I like, again, it's something that's kind of like tongue in cheek a little bit, like my corn cob pipe, loving the fall events, but I do think there are some great moments usually. And like, as you said, like great winners in the fall. Is it something that I'm going to watch religiously? Definitely not, because there is football and there's other like things to watch, but yeah, I still like following it and I'm just okay with it existing. Again, you know, it's like more opportunities for the players, more opportunities to watch golf if you like golf. And I guess it's like, for me, it's like, what's the downside here? You know what I mean?
Right.
You can just opt out. Like, nobody has to do anything. People are kind of like, well, I feel overwhelmed by there's so many golf. And I understand that, especially in a Ryder Cup year, because the Ryder Cup is such a perfect emotional climax to the golf season.
Good
that
point.
Then you're like, wait a second, like now there's like, we're not even taking like a 2 month break or anything.
Right.
So I get that. But yeah, I would just go back and saying just, yeah, opt out if you don't like it.
Kind what of were thing. Some of the other fall moments in your article, Golf Digest?
Yeah, I'm looking like, now. So like Justin Thomas got his first win. He made like a double bogey on 14. This was at the CIMB in Malaysia in 2015.
I missed that event.
Comeback to beat Adam Scott. You had Victor Hovland at the Mayakoba last year, where he made like a 12-foot putt or something like that.
Yep.
I embedded the tweet with the Norwegians calling it. It's like so good. Like the excited Norwegian call of his putt is great. Then you had there's a five-person playoff. Sergio won with a great iron shot on the 18th at Sanderson. Yeah, Rory winning this year. Bryson DeChambeau's first win, where he made a huge eagle, and then you know, a couple others that are less exciting probably. But yeah, it's just kind of the point of, like, you know, what else do you write in the fall? Like, you write about fall events. Yeah, there's some, like, there are some good moments here every year.
That I guess that's the theme, listening to, like, first wins, is like, it is an introduction, right? It's an opportunity. Yeah. The stakes may not be the highest, but it's sort of an intro paragraph to maybe some greater careers, whether it's JT or a Bryson. The one thing I struggle with is Rory, like, we don't need to get into a Rory discussion, is like, what's additive for him playing these events? Like, he's obviously, yeah, he plays for legacy. He talks about that, right? He said it this week, or he's like, the Saudi thing is a money grab and I'm playing for legacy. But, like, yeah, what's additive to his resume winning in a fall event, right? But I think, like, this year it was like a nice round number. I got to 20 PGA Tour wins. That was like a big deal. So I think that's the balance. I think we should probably take it for whether it's like a rookie mini camp kind of thing or a summer league, NBA summer league type stuff, where there's these curiosities and amusements. And then you also get to see these young players really show out for maybe the first time.
Yeah. Like, very little addition to his legacy, right? I mean, unless he finishes with 20 wins, or, you know, if he never wins again, then he'd be like, yeah, it's good that he won that CJ Cup. But Yeah. For Rory, there's not much. And yeah, the PGA, the tour is obviously trying to strike that balance between, you know, we need to have good players in these fields, like, so that it's not just a rookie mini camp, because that would be even less, you know, interesting. And so they do, I think they tweak the rules a little bit so that these guys, they probably could take off to the new year, but it would make things very difficult with the requirements for the next year. So it sort of behooves them to play one here or there. And that's kind of what they were after. So you get Rory, you get Hideki, whatever.
Sure.
And so, yeah, it is a combo thing. Again, you and I, I'm sure, are so sick of writing the story where it's like, hey, this guy won and transformed his career. This guy that, like, probably won't win again for 3 years and that nobody really cares about. But it's still a story, right? I mean, that is still a really big deal for that guy who wins that. So you can have these things where, and then as we saw, like, DeChambeau, Justin Thomas, like, a lot of these guys got their first wins in the fall, and we can kind of get a taste of what might be coming down the pipeline for them. So there's, like, little nuggets here and there. And yeah, I mean, I hope I'm not coming off like a propagandist for fall golf here.
No, not at all. We get it. There's enough negativity around it. Like, any kind of balanced view of it, I think, probably comes off as too positive, because all it is people seem to bag on it, you know? So
totally. Yeah. Like, so in a week when I'm not covering it, if I'm, you know, at home and I'm not working or whatever, it's like, yeah, like, if all it is, is that in the last 2 hours, I get to, like, watch Victor Hovland try to close out a tournament, you know what I mean? Or if I just catch it for an hour at the end, or Rory, like, that's good enough for me for fall golf. And I'm glad it's there.
The one that sticks out in my mind is Charles Howell III winning here after like 11 years off the RSM. Totally. Like, I don't know, that maybe that's an argument for that. He made so much freaking money over 10 years, but never actually won. So like, you do get those mix of moments that doesn't happen if there's not a fall series or fall events. So, and that's something that whenever that happened, I don't know what that was, 3 years ago now, either way, it's in my memory bank. So
my, the first tournament I covered for the Slaying the Tiger run was in 2013 here at Sea Island. And it came down to Briney Baird, who was, I think, maybe still, like, the most money for someone who never won, versus Chris Kirk. And Chris Kirk was coming up. And it meant the world to Briney Baird. And you could tell the pressure. And Chris Kirk was, like, young and, you know, had no scar tissue, really. And Briney Baird lost. And, like, seeing him after the trailer, he was completely heartbroken. But, you know, that's, like, real drama, real personal drama that, again, like, not many people are going to, like, find it in their hearts to care about Briney Baird, but being there, it was like, oh my God, like, what a devastation for this guy.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of stuff always too.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will read that stuff from you. You'll be Golf Digest. Are you staying through the weekend?
Yeah, I'm here the whole time.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Shane Ryan, for joining us. The book is The Cup They Couldn't Lose. You can order it now. We'll read you at Golf Digest. Follow you on Twitter. Are you still, what are you, Shane Ryan Here? Is that what it is?
Shane Ryan Here. Yeah.
At Shane Ryan Here. Shane, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Brendan.
All right, have a good one.